Isaiah chapter 42, verses 1 through 9. Here is my servant whom I uphold, my chosen, in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. He will not cry or lift up his voice or make it heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and a dimly burning wick he will not quench. He will faithfully bring forth justice. He will not grow faint or be crushed until he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands wait for his teaching. Thus says God the Lord, who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread out the earth and what comes from it, who gives breath to the people upon it and spirit to those who walk in it. I am the Lord. I have called you in righteousness. I have taken you by the hand and kept you. I have given you as a covenant to the people, a light to the nations, to open the eyes that are blind, to bring out the prisoners from the dungeon, from the prison who sit in darkness. I am the Lord. That is my name. My glory I give to no other, nor my praise to idols. See, the former things have come to pass, and the new things I now declare. Before they spring forth, I tell you of them. May God bless the reading and receiving of His Word.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you, George. As Chris mentioned earlier, this particular passage is one of those that is considered one of the servant songs in Isaiah. We did not read the entire passage. In fact, starting in verse 6, there's actually a poem or a hymn about God and about this servant, which, interestingly enough, if you know anything about Hebrew numerology, contains three sections of seven lines each. Both indications of wholeness and completion and God's presence. But I don't want to concentrate there today. I want to talk about some other things, and that is God's just servant. I will tell you that it's kind of interesting that this had been done for a while, and then at the meeting last week, conference and retreat, Dr. Brian Bibb was speaking on reading and teaching the prophets. And while he didn't read from Isaiah 42, but from other places in Isaiah, he reminded some of the folks there, well, reminded us all, that oftentimes when we as Christians read the prophets, we read the prophets with nothing but a Christian perspective, and we forget that there was a meaning for the folks at the time in which it was written. Sometimes a good meaning, sometimes not so good. And that among the various things we need to do as Christians when we read the prophets is kind of put our Christian perspective on hold briefly, look at it historically, not only from the time frame, but from the vision of Israel or the prophet who is ministering in Israel or Judah, and then come back after we understand that to our Christian perspective and try to connect the two. Because after all, the God of the Hebrews is the same God of the Christian. And it is a Judeo-Christian heritage. So I would begin by asking, who is the servant of the Lord? I am asking, who is the servant of the Lord? What's the first thing that comes to mind? Jesus. Some might say, the Messiah. Some might say, the Christ. But Jesus is the first one that comes to mind. And while this particular passage eventually does come to fruition in Jesus, the Christ, it also had a particular meaning at the time it was spoken for the folks who were living in that time period. Doesn't do them any good to say, seven centuries from now, this is going to happen, because they're not going to care. They're going to be dead by then. So it has to have some kind of meaning for their time and for their lives. And so while we as Christians look at the servant of the Lord and we think, okay, it's Jesus, it's the Messiah, it's the Christ, for Isaiah's time period, for the people to whom this is delivered, that is not what they're thinking or what they understand, and really that's not what it means for them at that point in history. Instead, the servant of the Lord is the corporate entity of Israel. It is the nation, individually and together. The servant of the Lord is the nation of Israel. The servant of the Lord is each individual who is a part of that nation, who follows God. And so this particular section, while later on God does greater things in Jesus the Christ, at the time it was spoken and at the time it was written, speaks to the mission of the servant nation, Israel. And if we as Christians then are going to make a Christian connection, it doesn't just speak about Jesus, it also speaks about the servant nation, the church. The church. Now, this passage was very possibly in Jesus' mind at His baptism and other key points in His earthly ministry. But this servant nation here is being singled out to serve in the time period in which Israel was living at that point in history. The servant is seen as a teacher of others. A teacher of others. And the teaching is the standard by which all nations will be judged, including the servant. The notion here is that that standard is how they live up to their calling by God. Notice I didn't say how they spoke the creeds or the liturgies, but how they lived up to the calling of God. And the standard which God puts before them toward which to strive. Here the nation, or as I guess I better refer to it as the servant nation. The servant nation is one of the prophetic roles that Israel was to play. Israel was given God's message. Throughout Israel's history, Israel was expected, actually, to tell others about the greatness of God and how their gods were really not gods and they needed to come to Yahweh. Except, as we know, some of them were faithful, but many of them saw themselves as an exclusive little group. God's chosen ones. And they set up their own standards by which one could become a part of that nation. But that's not what it was meant to be. They were given God's message for the nations: liberation, reconciliation, forgiveness of sins. And were supposed to teach that to others. Oftentimes they, and oftentimes we in Christian churches, we as individual Christians, wait for an outpouring of the Spirit before we move. We'll have a vision, but before we move, we want God's Spirit to move us. As one writer stated, if we see the vision clearly, that is God's Spirit giving us the vision. And rather than wait, we should teach. We should teach and share that message, because the power is in the speaking and the living of the message. That's a thoroughly Middle Eastern, ancient Middle Eastern understanding. But it's also an understanding of Christianity. That the true power is found in living and speaking in God's Spirit. The nation is in covenant with God. And the nation is a missionary nation. A missionary nation. We are to be telling others about that which we have found. But as in verse 2 we find, we are not to be boisterously tooting our own horn. We're to speak with a still small voice that knows God and is known by God. As one writer put it, and I quote, "A nation's genuine service to mankind and the modesty with which it is discharged are the persuasive commendations of God." In other words, if we scream and shout and seek to force, that's not the commendation of God. It is God who comes in the still quiet voice of knowing. And more often it is in our quiet living that others see Christ, not in our waving of our Bibles or shoving of tracts under people's noses, but rather in the quiet, constant living, knowing God. As a chosen servant nation, we are singled out by God for a purpose, and we're offered the opportunity to fulfill that purpose. We're not chosen, predestined to be in heaven. We're chosen to fulfill a purpose. And yet, we are given the opportunity to choose whether to fulfill it or not. It is a supreme obligation when chosen to do God's service that we have to choose then to follow. And when we do, God will endow us with the Spirit to do the task well and to bring delight to God and to others. But there is to be no coercion. God does not force Himself. God does not force His forgiveness upon us. Therefore, we are not, as the servant nation, to impose our will or lifestyle on others, even pagans and the irreligious are like bruised reeds. And when it reads here that He will not bruise a reed, it's not just talking about Jesus being bruised for our transgressions. What it is talking about here is that the servant of God comes with mercy and compassion for others, bringing a word of justice for sin, yes, but more importantly, bringing a message of forgiveness and grace. And not, as I so often say, shooting the wounded. Those who are already bruised and battered by the world do not need us to come in and browbeat them and bruise them again. But rather they need for God's servant nation, God's just and fair servants, to bring that message of reconciliation and grace. In a quiet and gentle manner, the servant of God patiently effects the desires of God. In fact, in verses 3 and following, we're told that the servant faithfully and constantly brings that message of grace. It's an effort to establish justice and mercy, respect for human dignity, freedom of thought, speech, and religion. Even in the Old Testament, freedom of thought, speech, and religion. And to seek to build up the mind, body, and soul faithfully and constantly within our own lives and the lives of those with whom we come in contact. You know, if you think about it, people see the shattered world all around them. People know of harshness already. They don't need for us to come in and scream and shout and stomp and condemn, because they have already seen the harshness of the world, and some of them the harshness of their own sins. The servant isn't to bring that kind of justice and law, for people are in need of good tidings, of great joy. Reconciliation by God through not only a Savior, but reconciliation through God's just servants, you and me and others. God's coming is both judgment on sin and the creative act of restoration for those who will come back to Him. The servant nation is called to be a light of revelation. It's not just Jesus that's the light of revelation, but when we come to God, we are called to be. You learned it as a child. You're right, Chris. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. Of course, you know, you're not going to let Satan blow it out. But you know, Jesus said something about lighting lights. He said, people don't go in and light a light if it's going to light. You don't light a candle and then hide it under a bushel. Now, do you? No. It's there to light the room. We're there to serve as lights, to light the world. By the way, there's another reason that you don't light the candle and put it under a bushel. You'll burn the bushel basket up. But we're to be those lights. The servant is called to shine with that which God gives. Our mission as God's just servants is reconciliation of others to God and with ourselves, and to share that light, not dimly. We will not fail. The verse says, He will not fail. And literally the Hebrew means to burn dimly. Or be discouraged, which means to be bruised. But we will continue. And the covenant people who have been entrusted with that teaching are to be faithful and continue to keep the light shining. The light of God's grace. And not just law. We as Christians are to have the mind of Christ as an ongoing standard, even when times are difficult. We're to hold on to that light of Christ and tell that message. But you know, sometimes that's easy. It really is. Sometimes that's what holds us up. You ever said to somebody, the only thing that got me through was holding on to that message, holding on to that hope. And that's not bad. This is an incense burning, by the way. That's not bad. But sometimes the difficult time to really hold that standard high is when things are going well, because we become complacent and we forget that we don't hold the message to ourselves. We share the message in the ways we live. Most people, if you mention the name of Jonathan Edwards, if they remember it at all or know anything about it at all, they say, oh, he was the preacher that had that terrifying sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. But at one point he wrote about religion in other ways, and I quote, "The degree of religion is to be judged of by its fixedness and strength of habit exercised in affection." In other words, our religion is not based on how many times we say the creed, but rather the strength of our habit based on our affection for God and for God's church. We are to be free but faithful participants in God's life and the mission of the servant. And we're given that commission by God. And I finish up here briefly, starting in verse 6 in this poem. Verses 6 through 9. We're told, first of all, we are given that commission from God the Lord. It's not just any God. This is the Lord. F.D. Maurice wrote, "The great disease of our time is that we talk about God and about our religion and do not confess Him as a living God daily." By the way, he wrote that in 1884. Interesting. Some of you probably thought he wrote it just recently. "The great disease of our time is that we talk about God and about our religion and do not confess Him as a living God daily." And we confess Him not by our words alone, but by the way we live. In these verses, we are told that God, who commissions us, is indeed our Lord. He calls us in righteousness, that is, both in right relationships with Him and to a consistent purpose to share Him. And we don't do it alone, for He leads us, He grasps us, He forms and keeps us, and He calls us to be a covenantal light to all the peoples as we embody God's covenant. To open eyes that are blind, even our own sometimes. To liberate people from darkness and bondage. And to liberate them from a lack of understanding. To make things new. And to restore relationships. God did all of this in a very special way in Jesus. But we can't just rest upon that. Because Isaiah was calling Israel to be even more and to continue God's grace and reconciliation through themselves and their lives. And if we as Christians then look at this in its historical context and then make that connection with our Christian calling, guess what? We come up with the same message and the same calling, that we are to be God's just and fair servants, sharing God's restoration of relationships, the giving of life, the grace that God wishes for all. That is not just a part of our being a Christian. It is specifically a part of we who call ourselves Baptists. And if you would take the handout in your bulletin, and before our closing hymn, shall we read responsively together? Brothers and sisters in Christ, God is on a mission. And the incredible good news is that God invites us to participate in that mission. We must rediscover the Baptist heritage and renew the Baptist witness. At its best, the Baptist heritage and witness brilliantly reflect the spirit of the New Testament church and the Christian faith. Therefore, we need to rediscover the bedrock biblical principles of our heritage. The mission calls. Let us rediscover the Baptist heritage and renew the Baptist witness. It's time. And it is that calling which we receive from God that is timeless as we walk with Him, sharing that good news. Our closing hymn is hymn number 665. O Master, let me walk with Thee. That is not only our calling, that is our privilege, and it is our responsibility to walk with God, to share in the message and the ministry of reconciliation. Our altar is open for any decision that you might make, for Christ to become a part of this fellowship or to renew your calling as God's just servant. Number 665.